The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
As you'll have heard, the former swimming coach George Gibney has been convicted of sexually abusing four young swimmers and the attempted rape of one of the girls in the 70s and the 80s. He was originally charged with 79 counts but pleaded guilty to five at the beginning of the trial. And one of the first people to speak out about the abuse he suffered was the former swimming coach Chalky White. And Chalky is with me now. Hello, Chalky.
Hello, Claire. How are you?
I'm good. It's nice to talk to you. And the first thing I have to ask you is how you are today.
Mixed, I suppose, would say. There's a certain amount of relief that he's now a convicted paedophile. But this wasn't kind of a case where anything, you could feel satisfied at the end of everything. A lot of people have been hurt, a lot of people being damaged. And I think the only consolation really is right now is that he's going to end up in jail. And for all the years that we chased him and for all the people that helped in that chasing, I really appreciate all that. My heart really kind of goes out to the latest witnesses that kind of went through the trial last week, because they really kind of saved us all. They came out of the second captain's podcast by Mark Horgan, where's George Gibney. They came forward, and as a result, he was extradited from the States. Up until then, we really had given up all hope that he would ever. We knew that he would be chased around the world, but never thought that he would end up back in Ireland and back in jail. So to the girls that actually were brave enough to come forward and that, really say thank you very much, because you saved us all.
Yeah, I was looking back on an interview you did in 2017 with Donal Lynch in the Sunday Independent, and at that stage you said you were sick of it all, that every time it came up it brought up another bout of depression. You didn't have any hope that they would ever get him. I mean, has that changed now with this verdict?
Immediately after the verdict yesterday, I didn't think. I was still in the same frame of mind. It took about an hour or two for me to realise a lot of the problems before was exactly that. Whenever I would get contacted, it would be, I said to some people, please don't start into this unless you're going to finish it. With it is now over and done with. Whenever I'm asked about it, even with you now, I don't have to worry about that he's still out there and he's going from place to place and probably from child to child. That's all over. There's a huge relief on that. I don't have to worry about that part. All I have to deal with and manage now is him in my head for the rest of my life.
And is he in your head?
Oh, 100%. He's never been out of it. You don't forget things like that.
It started when you were very young. I mean, you started swimming when you were around seven, am I right, Chalky?
I started at seven, but I started to really kind of come through at 9 and 10. And that's when he really, I fit everything. I was a decent swimmer at the time, but I was also vulnerable. I needed somebody to help me get there. There are strong people who don't need a coach or anything like that. They usually will avoid these kind of situations. But I was the type that, yeah, I felt that I needed him. He was going to make me great. And he groomed me over a while, where he became almost my father figure. Even though now I'm kind of shocked, and I only realized it when he was extradited. He was only 7 years older than me. So he was in his teens when he started. Mm-hmm. That really kind of got me a lot. But now, like you say, he's convicted, and I don't really have to worry about when it's brought up, people are always saying, well, maybe they'll get him eventually. He's done.
And you mentioned the podcast that Mark Horgan and Kieran Cassidy put together, which was instrumental in getting to this point. It's called Where Is George Gibney, made for the BBC. And in that, we hear you telling the story about the conversation you had with Gary O'Toole on the plane going to the World Championships all those years ago. I calculated it at 35 years ago that you had that chat with Gary, which prompted 26, Gary then.
Yeah, 26th of December 1989.
Gosh, you remember it to the day.
Yeah, 100%.
So you, Gary, how did that happen? Did Gary ask you a couple of questions, or did you just start talking to Gary about what had happened?
No, we were on our way to the World Championships. I had got selected as one of the assistant coaches. We were on a long flight. We had gone I can't remember which leg we were on, whether it was from London to Singapore and then on to Sydney or to Perth. But on one of them, in the middle of the night, I got up and I was going up to the bathroom and noticed Gary's light was on. And on previous flights, we'd been playing chess that we kind of started into. So anyway, he was there and I kind of decided, oh, okay, I'll just sit down. And I was talking away to him and it was kind of comfortable. I didn't sit down with any intentions of talking about anything like that at all. It was just that, yeah, we were talking away. And things were going fine. I just said to him, how did he get on with his coach? And he gave me a sort of a nondescript answer. You know, some days go to the judge, you know, George, and of course I do know him, you know. So I said, well, you know, has he ever done anything to you that you didn't like, if that's the case? And he goes, what do you mean? And the conversation then, he kept pushing me. And I said, well, did he ever do anything that he shouldn't have done? And eventually we got around to talking about the sex and all the rest, you know, that had happened to me when I was younger. And he was just shocked. And but it was the first time really where I had really talked to anybody about it. I had asked one or two people like Derry O'Rourke, the worst person. One time I said to Derry O'Rourke what had actually happened. And Derry said, oh, I wouldn't tell anybody about that. Now, I'll go into that another time. But mm-hmm. Gary,
well, he's
was
now
very
convicted too. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. So he told you not to tell anybody.
He told me not to tell anybody that it wouldn't look good on me, that if I got out, you know, I honestly don't want to go into the conversation.
No, look, and you don't have to go into anything you're uncomfortable with.
Yeah. It would stigmatise people and I prefer not to do that.
No, that's fine. So the conversation with Gary happened. Did you feel, because it was the first time you've spoken about it at that point all those years ago, did you feel really exposed at that point or did you feel relieved? What was your sense?
I was in no way relieved. Gary made me feel a lot more comfortable about it. Gary actually just said, at the time when I was telling him, he was shocked. He didn't realise anything like that had happened. We didn't talk much more about it. He just said, I've got to look into this. And then over the next couple of weeks while we were in Australia, he, you know, at various different times, he would just reiterate to me that he was shocked and that he was not going to let it sit. And, you know, I was trying to get him off that, you know, we're at the World Championships, you've got to concentrate on your event and all the rest. And he did. But, you know, it was in the forefront of his mind. Some things that I regret, you know, should I have said it to him then? Did I actually impact his overall career? All those kind of things went through my mind. So on the flight, I didn't set out to talk to him about it. It happened. And out of that, it spiraled. I'm really happy that he did what he did, but I was also shocked. Mm-hmm. It was months later when I found out. I went back to a psychologist that I'd been attending, and he said that he had to report it to the police and that the police had followed up. And along with Gary, they had 60 different statements. And at that stage, this was about 6 months later, I was really, really floored, to be honest. I thought that I was the only person who had been impacted. And one of the times when I confronted George about it, I actually said, I'm afraid that I'm going to say something that will end me up in jail rather than you. And, you know, he denied that he ever did anything to me. But within a couple of seconds, he changed his whole attitude. And he says, when I come back from Australia, I'll resign. But that was in me confronting him.
Yeah.
Up until then, I believed that I was the only person. And then suddenly I'm told that there's 60 people who have made statements. I was shocked.
And then for people who don't know or don't remember, that prosecution, which is where it ended up, was stopped in 1993 by the Supreme Court. And he then left and went to Scotland and then to America.
And we were devastated. Because we were told as witnesses, he's off and they're not going to make any appeal to the judicial review. And for us, then we spent the rest of our life just thinking, okay, that's it. He went to Scotland. He went to the US. It was always swimming clubs. It was always younger people, and it just went on. And no matter who got involved, nothing ever really happened. So for us, it was just, that's the end of the line. We're just going to have to live with it and deal with it in our own heads. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you get this call from Mark, and he says he's going to do a podcast, Mark Horgan from Second Captains. And to be honest with you, I think I was in Florida at the time. I was working, and he called, and I kind of went to myself, oh, here we go again.
I don't blame you listening to you for the skepticism. I mean, here you are, you and 60 people have said what you've had to say to the people you should say it to the authorities, and your man is gone. And now you're being told there's a podcast coming. You know, I think anybody listening to this would understand that you would be skeptical, but you put that to one side and you did cooperate with it.
I did, to be honest with you, it was the podcast that kind of got me. I thought, all the media news, it was making a lot of waves, but it wasn't making the impact. I felt that, well, podcasts might reach more people. It was just a hope, and because it was being done by BBC, I thought it was going to be, it would have a lot more credibility. Then he met me in Florida, and I began to think, hold on, this is a bit more serious. Now, I know there have been lots of chasing George Gibney around, but this kind of just felt a little bit different. And then when it went out and the reaction it got, and we began to hear that more people were starting to present themselves to the police, that was like, oh, great. But even at that, there was a bit of skepticism until finally, like I say, they extradited him from the US last July, I think it was. At that stage, it was, oh my God, better get prepared for this, mm-hmm. because this is really going to happen this time around.
And to those girls,
I really say thanks.
And it's extraordinary what they've managed to achieve. It really is. When you say, I better prepare for this, I mean, I don't know how you do that. How do you prepare for it?
You've got to control what's in your head, because every time his name comes up, it triggers all of the emotions that go with it. And many, many, many tears, no question about it. So when something like this, you kind of have to say, well, okay, the last time it was in the depths, what did I actually do? So it's really a real learner for me was when I first of all went to work in Japan in the early years of this. I got away. I was working in Japan for about a month, and I realized I hadn't thought about this guy at all. So getting into situations where you're not around anybody really who brings it up helps. Now, you can't cut yourself off, but at this stage, you kind of learn how to, when it's starting to come, how you can even deal with the people as they come along and say, look, you know, not a good time, and it's easier to deal with it. But you do actually have to just manage what's going on in your head and be in control. But much in the way that we were taught when we were swimmers, you know, the visualization, you know, making sure you get all your splits right, how you train your mind to think about what it's supposed to be thinking about during the race and not thinking of anything else. So really you use those kind of approaches with the George Gibney thing to say, look, I'm here, I'm going to be doing this, I'm concentrating on this, I'm not going to be concentrating on George Gibney. Right? Now, you can say it's an avoidance, but it gets me through.
Gets you through. And you have lived in so many places over the course of your life, Chalky, haven't you? I mean, you've mentioned Florida, you've mentioned Japan, you were in South Africa for a while as well, weren't you?
I went to Japan, China, Thailand, Taiwan, Vietnam, Cambodia, Malaysia, India, the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all of Europe, Brazil, and Colombia.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but do you think, had that not happened to you in your childhood, that you would have had that sort of life?
It would have, I don't know if it would ever have turned out like that, because like I say, when I went to Japan and first, my initial reaction was I wasn't seeing the cars that he drove. I didn't see the people with the same sort of glasses looking like him with the hairstyles. There was nothing triggering when I went into a pool. I was in there on my own. There weren't other coaches who were either for or anti. So I found that when I was away, it was a way of actually blocking it out. And unfortunately, that was the way I had to deal with it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And do you still have therapy? I know that you have had in the past, and you've mentioned that in our conversation, but do you still do that?
No, I found, this wouldn't be really a good thing to say, but I found that actually they were taking me too further into it, and I really actually needed to stop. I understood everything that went on, why it went on, how it went on, whether I was right in thinking that I wanted it or whatever. You know, I've dealt with all of that. I don't really need to go through that troubling thing all over again. I understand it in my own head, and I just need to manage myself. And I really, nobody else can actually help me through it. It's like telling an irrational person to be rational. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody really understands what's going on in my head. I did get help at the time, and I learned from all the help that I got. But at this stage now, I just need to deal with myself and handle it in my own head and control it.
And how is your life now? Is your life good now?
My life is as good as it can be. And it's good for me. For other people, they would probably think it would be really good for them. It depends on where you're coming from. Day to day can be up, can be down, like anybody else. So I appreciate the fact that I actually have the days. And I've got my sons and my grandchildren that I really enjoy. And they make it all worthwhile. And everything I do is for them.
Chalky, I'm so glad that you chose to talk to us this morning. I really appreciate it. And also I want to mention Mark Horgan again and Kieran Cassidy, who came to you with that idea for the podcast, Where is George Gibney?, which led to this point where George Gibney will be sentenced on the 29th of July for sexually abusing four young swimmers, the attempted rape of one of those children in the 70s and the 80s. Chalky, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Claire, and I appreciate the attention that you've given to it.
Thank you. Chalky White there. If you've been affected by anything raised in this interview, please contact the National 24-Hour Rape Crisis Helpline. The number is 1-800-77-8888. The number, again, of the National 24-Hour Rape Crisis Helpline, 1-800-77-8888.
The Claire Byrne Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.